Thank you very much, Jörg. And today in the morning we have two sessions. The first session is when I read my paper. This time I read my paper. What is postmodern a quarter of a century after? This will be the paper. Then we will have the discussion about this paper. And when we finish this discussion, there will be the break. And after the break, there will be the general discussion. I already received a few questions in English, and I asked those who are keen to formulate the questions. They do not need to formulate them in writing. These questions I received in writing. They can also ask the question directly. There will be also interpretation, so translation. So you do not need to ask the questions in English. You can, but you do not need. But the first questions will be asked about the talk today, about what is postmodern a quarter of a century after. This paper is dedicated to my friend David Roberts from Melbourne, because when myself and my husband moved from Europe to Melbourne, we were still very much under the influence of the classicism of our teacher, Georg Lukács. And we met David Roberts, who started the work of education with us, introducing us to the appreciation of postmodern art. He did it in a very liberal fashion, not to criticizing us, but providing us with material, providing us with records, providing us with books, with albums from exhibitions, and slowly and surely we became far more postmodern than himself. This happened to me, and so I'm very grateful to David Roberts for his aesthetic education, not of humankind, of course, but of myself. So I start the lecture. No. Roughly 25 years ago, postmodern, together with its siblings as post-structuralism or deconstruction, appeared on the stage of the Western world, accompanied by a battle drum and trumpets. The cultural elite in countries where these elites still existed had to take sides for postmodernism or against postmodernism. Some of the partisans of postmodernism hailed it as the most up-to-date trend. Some of their enemies abused them as conservatives. Some sophisticated minds, whereas others be sophisticated. Some sophisticated minds praised them as liberators who finally put an end to the iron hand dictatorship of high modernism, whereas others bemoaned the unmistakable signs of cultural and artistic decay and of the commercialization of taste. Yet, although those belonging to either camp took a firm stand, when the simple question, philosophical question, what is it? Notably in this case, what is postmodern? Has been raised, almost everyone gave a different answer. Yet the dispute, the waves of which were very, very strongly disturbing our cultural life 25 years ago, calmed down already 15 years ago. They were going on stormily only for 10 years. As I see now, it exhibited an interesting melange of the language of high modernism and of the postmodern way of speaking in several varieties. So when you look back at the storm about postmodernism, hailing and despising, praising and finding disgust, you will see that there were two tendencies in this debate. One was very universalistic and the other was different. In case of universalism, it's a funny thing, because postmoderns rejected universalism, and still in their battle cry, there was a lot of universalism to be identified. So postmodern series spoke very frequently the language of universalism, mobilizing in the, its usual contrast of the new fighting against the old, the innovative challenging the fossilized, the progressive pushing back the conservative. That's an universalistic language of modernism, was repeated by postmoderns. Yes, postmodernism exhibited simultaneously a colorful heterogeneity, where everyone added a new color to the palette, and everyone spoke about something else than the other. Everyone spoke about something else than the other. Let me advance already here one of my conclusions. The postmodern perspective can claim at least momentary victory today simply on the ground that such and similar universalistic debates have since disappeared from the horizon of the secular culture world in the discussion of works of art. Sharp polemics may evolve around a singular event or a singular work, a happening, a building, perhaps an architect, an exhibition of a museum, about a novel, about a composer, about a performance. In such and similar debates, several perspectives can clash, be the clash purely artistic or include also political or ethical elements. Yet the battle cry of the controversies of the scene 25 years ago, like, this cannot be done anymore, this is out of date, this is not art at all, one can hardly hear today. Instead of the old battle cry, we practice a more subdued one, such, this is not good, this is unskillful, this we consider a failure, this might be dangerous, this is extremely boring, or this is ridiculous. Once upon a time, in 1982, in his, at that time, very famous lecture, Lyotard made a good point when he attempted to formulate the difference between pre-modern and modern thinking about art in the following way. He said, the pre-moderns ask what beauty is. The modern ask what art is. Today, however, one can raise both questions, although one does not need to raise either of them. So we can ask what is beauty, we can, what is art, not just what is beauty, or not just what is art. Yet in the just mentioned talk, Lyotard was first and foremost up to describe the specificity of the postmodern way of creating and judging. Several things that he believed to be a central issue in postmodern creation turned out later on as entirely marginal. Yet he put his finger at something important when he insisted that the postmodern language, regard, or perspective is a de-totalizing language, de-totalizing regard and perspective. True, Lyotard hailed the tendency of detotalizing with extreme pathos and an ultimate universality claim. He said, I am quoting Lyotard, we must declare war to the whole. We should bear witness to the non-representability. We ought to stand for difference. We ought to rescue the difference. We ought to rescue the honor of the name. It's extremely normative. It's extremely modernist. And this was the slogan by Lyotard, the postmodernist slogan. And especially rescue the honor of the name, as if the invisible Jewish God whose honor should be rescued by postmodern art, especially. To this otherwise fine remark, I would only add that also the rejection of holism is indeed one of the outstanding features of the postmodern perspective. Still, as it turned out, the presentation of the whole still remains one of the options among many options in postmodern art. Postmodern art is like a household where one can make use of very different ingredients. Or to speak philosophically, one might repeat with Leibniz that the best perspective is characterized by the greatest amount of heterogeneity in the smallest place. I repeat, that's Leibniz. The best is the greatest amount of heterogeneity in the smallest place. Taking one point stressed by Lyotard, I will now take one point stressed by Lyotard and will neglect all the others. Whether I agree or disagree with the other points, I now speak only about the tendency towards de-totalizing from a postmodern perspective, yet I do it without enthusiasm, without enthusiastic commitment. So I won't say you ought to, you must, you or rest, you don't know this kind of commitment. I will take up the issue in the following steps. So I will discuss the detotalizing tendency of postmodernism in the following steps. One, the detotalizing of the concept of history. Second, the detotalizing of the concept of truth. Three, the detotalizing of forms of life. Four, the detotalizing of concepts of arts and artistic practices. Finally, five, I will speak briefly about the postmodern arrangement of museums. Why do I discuss detotalizing exactly in this sequence will be clear, at least I hope, at the end of this paper. There is one single thought I need to advance. Retotalizing, among others also in the today fashionable fundamentalism, is but an answer to detotalizing, the result and seeming reversal of the former. But the reversal is in one important sense only a seeming one, for this newly bred holism, fundamentalism, more often than not, is nothing else but retotalization of a fragment. That if you retotalize a fragment, you can get a fundamentalistic attitude or policy. Now, I start with my first point, retotalization of the concept of history. It is obvious to begin with the phenomenon of detotalizing the understanding of history, since the decline of the grand narrative and the deconstruction of metaphysics became by now a philosophical commonplace. It could be perhaps still added that the decline of grand narrative concluded directly from the destruction of metaphysics, since the grand narrative was the most significant attempt so far to modernize metaphysics while temporizing it in the form of world history. That is, taking away the special hierarchical conception of metaphysics and temporalizing it, making historical. In the grand debate 25 years ago, this was not yet evident. The first postmodern spoke with gusto about the end of history and the dawn of post-histoire. This was often so interpreted as a declaration of a new age. We left behind the modern age and we stepped into another, to a postmodern age. This idea, similarly to the declaration by Lyotard mentioned above, we should, we must, we ought, was deeply rooted in the tradition of modernistic thinking, which it meant to have overcome. Because it is exactly in the spirit of the grand narrative that we have to step from an old epoch into a new epoch, and that we need also to be able to give a fairly precise account about the period we left behind, and somehow also to describe the specificity of a new period. That's traditional modernism. That's also the grand narrative. This is not de-totalizing. It is only then that we can speak of de-totalizing, when the conception of change in perspective is substituted for the conception of the change of periods. So we can start to speak about postmodern, that is, de-totalization, if the change in perspective replaces the change of periods, a change of ages. We don't speak anymore that this age is followed by a new one, but we speak about a perspective which has been followed by another perspective, a different perspective. To paraphrase Hegel, it is not the case that we postmoderns finally succeed in looking at history rationally, and thus history will look back at us finally also rationally. But because we look at history, or rather histories, differently, history and histories will look back at us also differently. I could formulate the situation with a little simplification in the following way. The postmodern interpretation of modernity has replaced the modernist interpretation of modernity, that is, we see ourselves differently than before. And since we look at modernity differently than before, we see it also differently, not only as far as its content, but also as its structure is concerned. We do not see it anymore as a whole, where everything is quasi-organically related to everything else. We don't see it either as an epic poem, where the story ends with marriage or with death. Rather, we see history as a mosaic that consists of heterogeneous pieces of colored glass, which do not even fit mostly entirely together. Seen from this perspective, modernity cannot be regarded either as a progressive or a regressive period of history, even if from one aspect one can see progress, and from another aspect one notices regress, and in a third aspect one can notice both. Precisely due to the heterogeneity of the modern world, as we see it, is there place here for action? Is there place here for decision and for evaluation? Seen from the de-totalizing perspective of the postmodern, the modern world is fragile and we know very little about its future. This is another reason to believe that action, decision, evaluation might here make a difference. In my little old-fashioned formulation, the postmodern perspective is the self-consciousness of modernity. Yet, when speaking of the postmodern perspective as about the self-consciousness of modernity, I have not offered a definition of postmodern. I do not offer a definition of the postmodern. Just as little as if in my confession that from this and this moment onwards I will understand my own life differently would serve as a definition of my life. So you can say that from this moment on I see my own life in different lights. I recapitulate or retell the story of my own life from this moment differently does not mean that I offer a definition of my life. It's not the case. The simile is not very much forced, since generations do not change their perspectives about their own life at an entirely contingent moment. The reversal or change of the gaze looking at modernity is not independent of historical events, and especially of historical traumas, and the analytical work which have been performed on these traumas. That is the experience with Nazism, with Stalinism, the work performed on those traumatic experiences, and even the movements of 1968, the so-called New Left, prompted the reversal of the regard. The gestation of a detotalizing position was already noticeable in certain tendencies of the 1968 events and movements. Further on, the decomposition of the grand narrative was reinforced by the experience of increasing globalization, in addition from two aspects. The globalization contributed to the reversal of our position, our gaze about modernity. First, because due to globalization, the spatial arrangement, that speciality, begins to play an important role, as important a role as temporality in historical narratives. We are living together, different cultures are co-temporal. Moreover, time experience appears now as a space experience, also as a state experience. Secondly, because almost every people, group, ethnicity, religion, form of life, culture, seeks to establish its own identity as difference within a shared modern culture. I have already mentioned that this identity-forming trend can also end up in totalizing and thus in fundamentalism in its local and non-universalizing shape. Finally, I must add that from a postmodern perspective, the postmodern perspective itself is regarded with irony and a grain of skepticism. One cannot declare confidently from a postmodern perspective that one has overcome all the errors of the modern perspective. And finally, we know what modernity is. We cannot say that. They regard us, they see us with a grain of skepticism and with some kind of irony, self-reflection. So much about the detotalizing of the concept of history. Now I come to talk about detotalizing of the concept of truth. 25 years ago and in the following decade, the charge of having relativized truth, or rather the concept of truth, was brought against the so-called postmodern thinkers, Foucault and Derrida included. The charge is a sheer nonsense, since one can speak of relative only if one has already subscribed to an absolute, for example, to the Hegelian system. Yet the detotalizing of the concept of truth questions the relative together with the absolute. So if you detotalize the concept of truth, you question the relevance of the concept of relative as much as of the absolute. Needless to say, the tendency to detotalize truth is not a recent development. It starts in the Age of Enlightenment, when the authority of reason became queried, or at least kept within a boundary. After all, absolute truth, the certainty of reason, presupposes an ultimate authority which warrants it. God could no longer remain the absolute warranty, at least not in mainstream philosophical thinking. The grand narrative replaced God, insofar as it presented the absolute, the truth, as the certainty, in contrast to subjective, primitive certainties as the result of historical development. The whole is the truth. Simultaneously, the holistic concept of truth has been replaced in the 19th century by the regional concept of truth, which is the concept of true knowledge. True knowledge in something, in this thing, in that thing. This new concept leaves behind the metaphysical claim, for it accepts as true only statements or theories which remain open to falsification. So in modern science, whether you speak about statements or theories, they can raise claim to truth only if they can be falsified. only if it can be proven that they are false. If our statement of theory cannot be proven that it might be false, this statement of theory cannot be true. This is the modern concept of truth, the scientific concept. They must be open to falsification. At the same time, it preserves the legitimacy claim of the traditional concept of truth, given that science legitimate authenticates the sole truth for the time being. Whatever is scientific or claims to be scientific, it is believed to be by definition true. So what I want to say here, that the scientific truth itself makes the following statement. True is only a statement or a theory which can be falsified. But at the same time, it raises the universalistic claim. This is the only concept of truth which is relevant. That is, for example, revelatory truth is nonsense. Its mythology is just a fairy tale. Only this. That is the statement of falsification. This is provided, the statement about falsification provided from Max Weber to Popper were very significant sociologists and philosophers, and in science they absolutely accept this. Needless to say, the tendency to detotalize truth, it's not a recent development, of course. Whatever scientific, it claims to be true. No. Let me turn to the postmodern perspective. The postmodern perspective pluralizes also the scientific concept of true knowledge, insofar as it detotalizes it and treats it genealogically. That's the next step. In the postmodern perspective, even the scientific concept of truth is taken skeptically, regarded skeptically. The concept of true knowledge is also tested, detotalized, genealogically. Let me mention three essential steps in this direction. The first is well known, it's a theory of paradigms elaborated by Kuhn, which already introduced perspective of change into the understanding of scientific theories and their truths. As a second, I mentioned Foucault's Gambit, who substituted the genealogical question, how is truth produced, for the traditional question, what truth is. And the third mention, the deconstruction practiced by Derrida, who lets the text itself elaborating a truth and then erasing it. In Derrida's mind, all truth claims are deconstructed, but the concept of truth and of justice is not, because it cannot, since it is deconstruction itself. Now maybe if you are interested, I can elaborate this point, but I cannot go further in discussing Derrida here. I go to the third point. Once upon a time, there was a slogan, anything goes. This slogan tried to make the process of detotalizing understandable and misunderstandable. Every story is a good one if we accept it. Every theory or description is true if it is plausible and if we can do something with it. Every painting, writing, piece of music qualifies for art if we decide so. Everyone lives in a way he pleases. Interpreted in this way, postmodern equals negative liberty, this time not for single persons alone. Not just I can do whatever pleases me, but in addition I do not break or hurt any norm or rule, and I am not censored or criticized by anyone for living such and such. So the question is not whether I can do what I wish or desire, or whether it is recognized by others that I can do whatever I wish and desire. From this interpretation, the enemies of the postmodern condition drew the too simplified conclusion that the so-called postmodern world will result in the dissolution of all social, moral, and artistic norms and rules, leading to absolute nihilism, while its then friends, the friends of the postmodern, were celebrating the end of terror, the long-awaited freedom, fantasy, wish fulfillment, and the satisfaction of desires. A quarter of a century after, one must admit that, at least as forms of life are concerned, many things now go without being generally censored or rejected. This is true especially about the increasing plurality of sexual relations and preferences. Ways of life which had been abhorred as unnatural, sheer madness, sinful on the one hand, or lionized as revolutionary on the other, became now taken for granted matter of routine. Homosexual marriage is just a claim for adjustment. Still, there is a tendency to the opposite, that less and less things are going than before. That is, there is opposite, and it still goes, yes, perhaps, but less and less things are going. One of the most telling examples everyone understands is the narrowing down of the career avenue. You can live as a lesbian, you can take seriously the creed of Christian Science, yet if you want to develop any of your abilities and you want to get a position you perhaps desire, you cannot do what you please or wish or else, since you must spend long years in schools, you need to earn several degrees. We can treat regulations and rules without irony, but it is rational to abide to them. The constraints are mobile, yet they are never entirely elastic. So there are things which you can do very little now. If you want to develop your abilities, you must go through the schooling system and you must get a degree, whether you are lesbian, homosexual, bisexual, or whatever. There is no possibility to achieve a position unless you go through these channels. So anything goes, but less and less. Yeah. It's possible. Anything goes. Sounds as an empty slogan, and perhaps the formula of a utopia. For some people a negative, for some others a positive utopia. In fact, many things one has desired to do 25 years ago are routine nowadays, yet many things was then free to practice and was promising with some rewards became no blind alley. Some things go, some others do not. And yet, one can also say that the slogan is still not as empty as it sounds. Anything goes that does not necessarily mean that everyone can do what she desires and get away with it, but that everyone can choose a form of life and get away with it. There are constraints in every form of life. Yet these constraints are different. I accept such and such constraints, for example, getting 3 degrees. The other accepts other constraints, living in the countryside and doing only occasional work. As in a well-known Australian film, one man chooses to submit himself to the constraints necessary for becoming a famous concert pianist, whereas the other plays rather in a country pub and lives in peace. Both finally enjoy what they are doing. The postmodern perspective allows for the person to conduct one way of life to understand the person who chooses an entirely different one without attributing moral or social superiority to any of them. This is indeed possible, although not widely practiced. Possible, yet not widely practiced. But is it obligatory to withhold judgment? Is it right to do so? So if you are confronted with plurality of forms of life, and you say, okay, everything goes, we cannot comment another person's way of life. But is it obligatory, ask the question, to withhold judgment? Or is it right to do so? This is the answer in the case of a talented pianist. but the alternatives are usually harder. After all, some can prefer life on drugs, whereas others can choose a life on the psychological and financial expense of another human being. One can keep others on a short leash of emotional and sexual dependency. The moral question cannot be answered in its generality. If you ask me to judge, there will be cases in which I will tell you, live as you please, only do not pass judgments upon us, and above all, do not force us to do what we do not want to do. Yet there will be cases that I would cry out with Voltaire, crush the infamous. The grand narratives, in both their progressive and decadent versions, identified enlightenment with modernity. Philosophies of progress promised that in modernity the project of enlightenment will carry through conflicts a final victory, albeit it is for the time being still an unfinished project. That's Habermas and others. Philosophers of decadence warned us that the destructive powers of enlightenment, after having been set free in modernity, will increase their destructive power until the collapse of Western civilization. From a postmodern perspective, modernity shows an altogether different picture. There are, of course, also among the confessed postmoderns a few thinkers, for example, Sigmund Bauman, who equate enlightenment and modernity in its cultural critical version. On my part, joining many others, I do not share this vision. In my understanding, enlightenment and modernity are by far not identical. Neither are humanism and enlightenment. Totalitarian systems like Nazi Germany or Stalinist Soviet Union were absolutely modern. Bauman would agree and add to this that Auschwitz and the Gulag have been descendants of enlightenment. This conception could be accepted only if one held the belief that Romanticism is the only legitimate branch of the tree of enlightenment. Yet, even if it is one of the branches, there are other branches of the same tree which mediate an entirely different message, as has been presented beautifully in Foucault's essay, What is Enlightenment? Nowadays, one could also point at new historical phenomena, such as religious fundamentalism, which turns openly against enlightenment, although it is modern beyond any doubt. To cut a long story short, postmodern perspective is pluralistic, and there are as many theories as thinkers presenting them. Yet one can safely say that it inherited something from Romanticism and something else from Enlightenment proper. That is, we postmoderns, I speak about myself, inherited something from Romanticism and something else from Enlightenment proper. From Romanticism, the sense of irony, from Enlightenment, the tendency towards skepticism. 4. Roughly a quarter of a century ago, the postmodern perspective occupied the stage as postmodernism, as a new tendency in arts in opposition to classical or to so-called high modernism. They started to speak about postmodern style in contrast to modernist style in architecture, and not without reason, given that Bauhaus on the one hand, minimalism on the other hand, were regarded as the dernier cri in modernist architecture. There were buildings constructed in a postmodern, that is, post-Bauhaus and post-minimalist style. Museums, hotels, and other public buildings were on their very body the defunct styles they quote, among other, the various forms of secession and sometimes even the styles of Italian fascism. Architecture and sculpture begin to merge. Unusual materials are used. Fantasy is set free. Modernists cried wolf and mobilized the faithful against commercial eclecticism and allegedly bad barbaric taste, but with little success. Obviously so, for if you only imagine a whole city populated by minimalist buildings alone, we would die of horror and boredom, even if we judge each and every minimalist building separately as sublime. One should not forget that both for Adorno and Leonhard, modernism embodies the sublime. Postmodern style in architecture gathered also immediately a decent army of following, also among sophisticated aesthetes, and thus the old story seemed to be reiterated once again, the new fighting the old. Not the buildings were fighting, but the ideas concerning building. These kind of battles belong now to the past, because one can build in all styles. Moreover, the style of each and every building became also personal. The sole aesthetic criteria are that the building impress us as uniquely beautiful, that is, attractive, and in Libeskind's own formulation, all buildings should tell their own story. As the Jewish Museum in Berlin, the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, or the new building of the MoMA in New York, verily do. They tell their own story. At the beginning, the true postmodern believers contrasted the freedom of postmodernist works and the ideas with terror of high modernism. That is, they always spoke about the terror of high modernism, and they claimed the liberty, the freedom of postmodernism. It would be impossible to deny that there was such a terror, practiced first and foremost by art critics, exhibition organizers, gallery owners, concert managers, estates, and especially by the numerous declarations and manifestos issued regularly by the ideologues of modernist schools. Adorno, for example, banned from using the common court, which allegedly represents reconciliation with an alienated world, in painting figurative works like those by Lucian Freud were looked at by disapproving eyes. In literature, there was zero tolerance for a linear story or for identifiable characters. If we have all those ideological restrictions in mind, postmodernism appears in fact as liberating, since it has not replaced ancient restrictions with new ones, but lifted all restrictions of a general kind. One can still believe with Nietzsche that it is easier or even more refined to dance in chains, but one can hardly say that the same chain are good for everyone. One can ask, of course, where modernism ends and postmodernism begins, but it does not make much sense, since neither modernism ended nor postmodernism began at one point. Whatever specific difference one may attribute to postmodernism, none of them will be helpful. Let us say, for example, so many people say that postmodern art is playful, and to prove it, and they prove it, among others, with the works of the recently deceased Niki de Saint-Phalle. Yet what about surrealism? Was it not playful enough? Or have they already been postmodern without knowing it? Let us say that installation is a postmodern genre. But what about Duchamp or Yves Klein? Have they been postmoderns? And where does postmodern begin, for example, in music? Where the common chord is living back, banned by Adorno, in Messiaen, or perhaps in Per, or only by the post-minimalist class? Yet from a postmodern perspective, one does not need to ask this question, and one usually does not ask this question. One does, in fact, not attach importance either to the questions or to the answers, precisely because one does not think in terms of the grand narrative. Let me briefly enumerate three different yet related aspects of this kind of thinking. We don't relate importance whether something was done today or yesterday or 10 years ago or 200 years ago. And at first I mentioned the problematic of historicism in art. Nowadays, one normally does not appreciate a work of art, be a novel, a painting, a piece of music or a building, whether one likes them or dislikes them dependent on the historical moment or the geographic place of its creation. So whether you like a work of art, you don't, does not depend on the historical period of its creation anymore. Cries of enthusiasm. Fantastic! Already in the 15th century he did this. How much he advanced his time. Or other kind of remarks. In his time in Paris, they painted already in the impressionistic style, whereas he still, and this, you know, you all came across with these remarks. They are no more in vogue. When a modernist who was guided round a wonderfully built, elegant and sophisticated medieval castle in Stockholm, you know, the castle where the Nobel Prize is normally presented. Now, when a sophisticated modernist went through the castle in Stockholm, very beautiful medieval castle, when he was informed that the castle was built in the 19th century, he immediately lost interest and stopped even looking at it. For an eye that looks at a building or at any work from postmodern perspective senses the beauty and has nothing to do with dating and to attribution. So if you enter the same building, you look at the beauty of the building and say, absolutely not interesting why it was built on the 19th century or the 15th century. It's not your problem. You look whether it's beautiful and how beautiful it is. Of course, surely monetary value has a lot to do with dating and attributing, especially case, in case of painting. But when the denizens of Budapest, to give an example of my home city, they can now this freely enjoy a neo-Gothic and eclectic parliament building. Whereas 50 years ago, a sophisticated citizen would have been ashamed to admit her love and appreciation. When I was a child, a sophisticated citizen would never admit that the parliament building is beautiful because it's eclectic. Yeah. It never would. We all learned in the 30s, that's another example, we all learned in the 30s that the beginning as well as the summit of modernist literature is Proust's novel on the one hand and Joyce's Ulysses on the other hand. Yet this historical pairing tells us very little today. For a contemporary reader, Ulysses has far more to do with Don Quixote than with remembrance of times past, whereas the novel of Proust seems far more to do with Balzac or Stendhal than with the novel by Joyce. And there are no few among us who admire one of them, but not the other, without shocking the sophisticated readers. We are no more in duty bound to consider Aristophanes as the greatest comedy writer among them all, because he was the first, oldest, and because he happened to be a Greek. From the postmodern perspective, there are no sacred cows, neither are there untouchables. This is why the practice of iconoclasm is now also groundless. We turn towards certain artists or works of art as we can also turn away from them, but there is no drama. Some culture critics warn us this is as much a loss as a gain. For if there is no agon, no fight in the world of art, artworks will lose their social significance. This may be true, but will not necessarily turn also true. The new generation can read, look, listen, decide, appreciate, evaluate in a far more personal way than it happened before. The question remains whether this practice turns judgment into subjective or contingent one, or whether it rather serves as a counterpoison against the tyranny of advertisement and culture industry. It needs to be added that Harold Bloom was right. The postmodern way of reading and thinking has not destroyed the so-called Western canon, only opened it up. The detotalizing concept of art is in mind the second most important feature of the postmodern way of thinking. The concept art is in fact not very old, yet essentially modern. It counts as a commonplace in cultural history that it has not occurred to anyone, for example, in the Middle Ages, to encompass in one and the same concept so different things such as sacred church music, marketplace comedy, lyric poetry, or a castle. Art, encompassing all of them and more, is a universalistic concept and as such a product of enlightenment. It made itself home especially on the European continent. The English language still distinguishes between art and literature, even if the English art theorists do not do it. The traditional universalistic concept, art, occupied a central role in the high modernist vision of the art world. Not because the concept was taken for granted as it used to be in the 19th century, but precisely because it was no longer taken for granted, because it became problematic. This was the reason that of Lyotard's already mentioned dictum that what is art became the decisive question of modernist vision. No more what is beauty, but what is art became the central issue of modernist vision. It follows from this claim and vision that all main tendencies and schools of the modernist art world, such as impressionism, expressionism, symbolism, secession, surrealism, dadaism, constructivism, minimalism, and so on and so on, had to make their presence in all kinds of arts, because they have to make their presence in art. They have to be there in painting, sculpture, architecture, music, and in all literary genres. Yet, arts are different. Genres within a kind of art are also different, and they resist vehemently to be subjected to the same tendency or the same school. If the pressure of famous art critics is too overwhelming, artists cannot resist, or at least they try to write or paint or compose as far as possible according to the last ideologically underpinned fashion. But we can try as hard as we do. There is no surrealistic music, neither is there surrealistic architecture, and though minimalism was forced upon literature, not without any success, it could boast with minor results compared with the essential ones in architecture or in music. The hidden or outspoken demand that the same tendencies should be presented in all kinds of arts at the same time, this really ideological terror has completely withered with the appearance of postmodern. A video artist is not interested what kind of styles are preferred in literature, if they prefer any. The moderns hear the autonomy of art. The postmodern hear the autonomy of every single work of art. Let me turn to the third specificity of postmodern practice in arts and art theory. It has been said and repeated since several years, sometimes with dismay, some other times with fervor, that there is no more avant-garde. And naturally, if there is no avant-garde, there is no arrière-garde either. This development resembles very much the shift in the understanding of history. One can do everything what has been done in the past. Figurative painting is back, so is realism and naturalism, yet one can also paint abstract and minimalist paintings because they have also their fans. Palimpsest becomes widespread. One can compose opera for the stage, symphony of the orchestra, electronic music, and one can compose music on the computer, and so on. In literature, one can compose texts, also minimalist texts, but all kind of novel is also back with its stories and characters. The idea that the past is constantly in the present appears in the postmodern staging of traditional works, whether operas, comedies, or tragedies. Everything is possible on the stage. Fantasy flies free. Here, verily, anything goes, if it works. Although there is no avant-garde in the sense that the new does not appear as a promise, as the redeeming yes, still there are new art forms. Some among them revive old, long time ago extinct genres. Once upon a time there was an art called living picture, and now it appears again. Silhouette or shadow play as art form was also mentioned by Kant, a critic of judgment. It is back. Video artists revived the wonderful and defunct style of silent movies. Other video artists conjure up the spirit of the Renaissance painting, for example, Bill Viola. The first photo artists of the 19th century presented their models frequently in period costumes. This kind of photography has been out of fashion for a very long time, yet now we enjoy it again in the works of Cindy Sherman and others. Blurring the limits of various art forms and genres, the tendency, which was already there in high modernism, continues. In this manner, not the arts have changed periods, rather the perspectives from which we look at them, and the ideas, the ideologies which surround them. This means, in this case, simply, that a work of art will be no better or no worse because it remains confined with the limits of one genre alone, or because it merges two or three genres in one. It does not decide upon the quality. I would like to return briefly to one of my former, perhaps enigmatic, sentences. Anything goes if it works. What does it mean that the work art works? That it impresses us as being art, that the listener or the viewer perceives it as such. There is no unanimous answer to this question, as there was no one to the question, why is something seen or heard as beautiful? This is, however, the slightest of our problems. One is not worried because there is no unanimous answer to the questions what makes something beautiful or what makes this and that a work of art, but because these questions are raised at all. Why do we consider those questions meaningful at all? There's a question, should we raise this question, shouldn't we raise these questions at all? I will answer one of these questions tentatively. Why cannot we help asking whether this or that work is a work of art? The question includes a hidden agenda, namely the other question. What makes a work of art a work of art? Since this question is, contrary to the one concerning beauty, a modern question, the answer, if there is an answer, many answers, is to this question itself, not to the question itself, but to the importance of the question. So the answer is not to the question, what is art, but the answer is an answer to the question concerning the importance to ask the question, what art is. This needs to be sought somewhere. So what we need to answer is, why is this question still important for us? Not what the question means, but why is the question, what is art, still important for us? Or if it is it important for us at all? This is the question. The modern world is a functional one. Instead of asking the question concerning essences, we ask questions concerning functions. The question concerning art is raised because we attribute a specific functions to works of art, not a specific substance, specific function to works of art, and we want to know whether this or that painted thing, piece of music or literature does perform this function or not, or whether it performs it well. To put it bluntly, in my view, the function of works of art in modernity is to offer us sense, render meaning to life experiences, illuminate those experiences, very painful experiences included, make us think them over, and do all this in a sensually enjoyable way, giving us pleasure. Most experiences in life give us both pleasure and pain, and those first and foremost are experiences of love, and they are the most significant ones. But they mostly do not provide us also with the meaning of those experiences, especially not the meaning of the painful ones. Many things, events, give us only pleasure without pain, a nice dress, a good dinner, an entertaining book, but we never expect them to live up to the function of sense rendering, especially not in the rendering sense to pain, trauma, grief. One can turn also to wisdom books or to philosophy, which may fulfill this function, yet they do it without offering sensual pleasure and joy. The chief difference between art and entertainment is, in my view, not that art is good and entertainment is bad. There is also bad art and there is good entertainment. The difference lies in their respective function. From this does not follow that good art cannot be entertaining. It often is. And it does not follow either that works created for entertainment will never render meaning or sense to one's experience. But because in the case of art and entertainment, we actually have different functions, still we deal in both cases with illocutionary acts. Advertisement can also be well done, witty and beautiful, but advertisement is a perlocutionary act because we expect a result outside the work. That is, the work should end up with a result which is not in the work. We should buy this thing, political advertisement or political posters. They are also perlocutionary because they want to persuade us that we should do something, we should believe in something, not believe in something else. They are rhetorical. That political posters like advertisements are rhetorical, whereas illocutionary art is like dialectics, they are not rhetorical. Bad art is the kind of art which does not perform its function because of poor quality, well-meant dilettantism, lack of talent, or being miscarried. It is a misunderstanding that since we do not expect from art critics to promote one tendency in art against another, there is no task left for them. They are expected to give their expert opinion, which includes practices in taste, whether a work is well done or a failure. Further, to put into the center, to promote the artist and the works of art, which, in their mind, perform the function of meaning rendering on the highest level and provide simultaneously the greatest satisfaction for our senses. I'll turn to the last question. One of the most popular slogans of modernist art theory sounded, demolish, raise down the museums. That's the question of the museum. The museum should be raised down. That was a conviction of modernists. No museums anymore. The museum suggests, they said, that the old masters were better than we. Some modernist music theorists declared the death of the opera. It is a bourgeois genre. It must leave the stage. Modernist writers declare that the old ones were conservative fools. For example, Louis Aragon organized a demonstration of avant-garde writers against Anatole France at his funeral. It is well known that political radicalism, both left and right radicalism, claimed a leading role in modernist movements and ideologies. The detotalization of the grand narrative resulted, among others, also in the disappearance of this kind of radicalism. One can abuse postmoderns as conservatives solely from the position of modernist radicalism. Postmoderns do not organize demonstrations at the funeral of a modernist writer because they do not like his style. They do not boo authors just because they represent another trend. Theater lovers visit the kind of theaters from which they can expect that they stage plays according to their taste. One can regret that there are no scandals. Yet where there is no scandal, there is no terror either. In between several things happened to the museum. One cannot expect any more to speak about museums in general. There are museums for everything, or almost for almost everything. Museums are the greatest tourist attractions. One can think randomly on Bilbao, one can think also on Barcelona, or the so-called Museum Viertel in Vienna. Among all these museums, the kind called Museum or Gallery of Fine Arts, the one which exhibits works of art or works of applied arts or perhaps also archaeological finds and incidentally all products of other cultures which can be also looked as if they were works of art, still occupy a proud of place. Traditional museums collected works which have supposedly already proved their timeless value. This was true also in times of modernism. Those were the museums modernists tried to demolish, at least in a spiritual sense. Instead of crushing the museums, the conception of the museum has changed in the last decades. The change took place roughly in three steps. First, the emergence of museums of contemporary art. Second, the rearrangement of the tradition. Third, the organization of concentration at single artworks with the means of anarchy. Since the traditional museums of fine arts allow for little rearrangement, which is by no means a shortcoming, I can mention only a few new museums or some new wings of the old ones. The most important innovation is the appearance of the Museum of Contemporary Art. The concept of the museum and the concept of being contemporary seem to contradict one another entirely. Yet only if we think of museums in the spirit of the grand narrative, then only the dead masters can have a place in a museum. The task of the museum is to keep the dead alive, to show that there are dead who will live forever because they will never be forgotten. The traditional museum is the temple of memory. Whoever enters the gate of this temple will repeat, just as one repeats in the temple the same liturgy, the same ceremony, about the same creed and about the same story. In contrast, the contemporary art museums collect the spirit of living artists. The conception does not include repetition. It can be presupposed that someone who enters this museum of contemporary art looks at the work for the first time, even if she is 8 years old and a frequent visitor to art galleries. It can be presupposed that no one could have seen this work before, because it has not yet existed. In a museum of contemporary art, the present undresses, shows itself, introduces itself. It raises claim to the sense, rendering function of art even by presenting itself as senseless. Well, you can render sense in presenting itself as senseless. But this remains the sole claim. The works presented in contemporary art museum do not necessarily and simultaneously also claim to eternal validity, not even for longevity. For example, an installation could hardly do it. Yet still, and in all cases, the regard the viewer casts at the object will be a yes vote or a no vote. It is only one additional thing I want to stress. An important new conception is developing in the artistic arrangement of museums in general, and especially in the newly established museums. Attention is concentrated on single art objects. That is, the context loses significance, for it is presupposed that the single work is its own context. This goes together with the problem of rejection of representation literature, of referentiality in literature, goes simultaneously. Now, literary theorists reject the representation and they criticize references, they speak about self-referential, the work of literature. This is basically the same in the arrangement of the museum, that a single work is its own context. It is indifferent, or it seems to be indifferent. Which other objects are placed close to it, before, beside, or above it? Once upon a time, modernist art theorists abused museums on the ground that it presents works out of context. We were advised that a medieval altar belongs in the medieval church. In the museum, it is out of context and thus not really meaningful. Museums inspired by the ideas of high modernism try to correct this blemish. A typical example is the Cloisters Museum in New York, where whole churches were built inside the museum to let the spectators see the sacred images in their quasi-original context. All this is sheer romanticism. There are several conceptions to arrange museums in our age, given that the postmodern position does not exclude any approach if it goes. Yet, as I mentioned, one of the significant conceptions of arrangement is exactly the context indifference. This is how one can exhibit in the same room four paintings, some pieces of furniture, a hanging scroll, Chinese hanging scroll, and a modern sculpture that is not created in the same time or the same place. This is indeed anarchy, but anarchy with a purpose. The spectator should concentrate on one object at one time, independently of the other ones. However, all this looks odd only for the eye used to the museum arrangement of classical or high modernism. If we cast a glance, for example, the aesthetics works of Hutchison and his works on aesthetics, we will see how he recommended in the 18th century exactly this contemporary principle to the wealthy nobility of Great Britain who aspired to populate their castles and their gardens with works of art and other things of beauty in good taste. Now this is what Hutchison really suggested. You have to arrange the paintings in a way that it will be possible that for the viewer to concentrate on one painting. Totally heterogeneous paintings should be placed beside each other. That was Hutchison's suggestion. Yet there is still an institution which has mostly, albeit not anywhere and always, preserved the spirit of the grand narrative, even after its demise. This is a central institution of art. It is the traditional gallery or museum of fine arts. Museums or galleries of fine arts generally embody the grand narrative in its classical best. This is so if they tell the whole story, like the Metropolitan Museum in New York or the Louvre in Paris. It is also the case if they present the spectator with one or the other chapter of one or one single thread of the story, like the British Museum or the Kunsthistorisches Museum or the Prado. All the museums or galleries of fine arts are in the last instance illustrations to Hegel's aesthetics. We start the story somewhere in the Orient, in Egypt, and in the region of Tigris and Euphrates, then follow with the Greeks, the Romans, the Middle Ages. At some point and somewhere, one has to insert also the works from the Far East. We don't know where. Then we turn to early modern art, where we divide it into nations. In the case of Italian Renaissance, cities, yeah? Florentine, 13th century, Siena, 13th century, Venice, 15th century, and so on. At some point and somewhere, one has to insert, there are galleries of English painting, German painting, French painting, Dutch art, yet within this and in similar grouping, the arrangements still need to follow the historical sequence. It is not easy to satisfy both criteria, time and nation, the spirit of the nation, and time a la Hegel. It's not so easy to satisfy both criteria in arranging a museum, yet they try hard. In the 19th century, also the styles enter the stage in arranging European and American art, again, in its quasi-historicist setting. There will be, for example, a cluster for French pre-impressionism, impressionist, post-impressionism, and so on. Sometimes the outcome is funny. I came across in New York Kandinsky under the cluster of German expressionism. Surely, the ancient can also be presented in a postmodernist manner, and there are already attempts at it, still very much resistant. Even such an innocent case as hanging one of Monet's water lily pictures in the vicinity of two contemporary postmodern works in the newly opened MoMA in New York met with the outcry by some art critics of New York Times, although essentially the historic arrangement has been preserved obediently almost everywhere in this newly arranged museum. One can, of course, ask the question as to whether only conservative habits resist innovations and the detotalizing of the traditional art galleries. Or is there perhaps an inherent value in looking at paintings, statues, and even at furniture and things of use as embodied history? Whether the attraction of this arrangement is an important and even warning sign? Or do we still need the crutch of the grand narrative? Or, let me reformulate the last question. Do we need a place in the world of art where the grand narrative can still feel at home? At an earlier point, I came up with the idea that detotalizing has its limits, both in daily practices and in the case of concepts such as truth, but that those limits are elastic, they are different in each case, and they are changing in time. I would now go further by asking the question, this is my last question, do the collections of the galleries, Museum of Fine Arts, the collection of the dead kept alive, indicate the limit to the detotalizing of the grand narrative? Is it just a habit, or also the sense-rendering function of art itself, which puts a fierce resistance against the total dismantling of the grand narratives in those traditional museums? And this is my last question, because I would tentatively answer the question in affirmative, although I do not know why. And I'm looking forward to discuss this now with you. Perhaps you will know the answer why. Thank you. So now we have a long, long period for questioning about postmodern, 25 years after. You can, please, Katie. The last question is, my question is, I asked the question whether there is a limit of the detotalization of the grand narrative. And I asked the question whether the very fact that in the tradition museums of fine art, they kept the story of grand narrative alive. Because the traditional museums of fine art, all of them basically, arrange paintings, sculptures, and even utensils and works of use, if they can be looked at as works of art, you know, as the collection of the dead, and the collection of that in historical sequence. That is, basically every art museum, traditional art museum, is an exemplification and the embodiment of Hegel. It's the embodiment of Hegel's aesthetics. You look at the art galleries and they basically embody in pieces, in bodies, the Hegelian aesthetics. My question was the following, whether it is necessary or it is good or is it meaningful to preserve also the grand narrative this time in the museum or not? Or is it just a bad tradition which must be overcome, will be overcome? Or is it something we preserve, that is basically like a zoo, yeah? As the zoo, in the zoo we can preserve animals which are no more present, whether you need, and it's very important to see these animals because you don't, cannot see them anymore in the forest. So it's very, know that they are, that these animals exist. Is there is not, not similar, something similar happening, that the grand narrative, which in our mind does not exist anymore, is preserved behind the walls of the art museums and art galleries. You go there like in a zoo, and you see the grand narrative embodied. So that's my question. Please stand up. Excuse me?
The question might, when you ask, might require another answer, previous answer, it would be, well, can you really get rid of this grand narrative?
That is...
Is it good or not? Whether we can use it or not?
Now that's a question whether we can, I do not make any prediction about the future. I do not exclude that in 25 years we return to the grand narrative. Now everything can happen, maybe return in the philosophy of history of the grand narrative, or in any, every kind of, any type of grand narrative, may return to it because if we don't see the future, we can speak of a foreseeable future for the time being. For the time being, metaphysics is deconstructed, and since grand narrative, the grand narrative was the last attempt to keep metaphysics alive. And that's not because that the most typical grand narrative of Hegel keeps metaphysics alive, keeps the conception that the whole is the truth, keeps the conception of the absolute truth, but keeps the conception not hierarchically. The absolute doesn't dwell there. We have not climbed to absolute truth. The absolute truth develops in history, and it arrived in the present. We arrived to the absolute truth in philosophy. In the present philosophy, which is consummation of the world history. Now, this is basically the metaphysics. It is not, it's anti-metaphysical metaphysics, but it still keeps the idea of the absolute truth as a result, not a beginning, not as an arche, but as a result, in a place. Now, this is also became not acceptable for our post-metaphysical mind, at least for the main and most significant thinkers and philosophers and scientists. This kind of grand narrative as the manifestation of spirit of our times. And since we are, in a way, imprisoned in our time, we think always, in a way, according to the spirit of our time, the grand narrative is a little bit out of joint. It is out of place from our time. But it's not out of place. That's my question. Why is it preserved? Everyone says that there is no grand narrative anymore. Everyone in philosophy, there is a consensus omnium here. And there, they forget about the museums of fine arts. How can we forget about the museum of fine arts? We enter and we see the grand narrative. We do not tell the story, we see the story before us. And my problem is that those who deconstruct metaphysics and who tell us that there is no grand narrative anymore, nowhere, totally lost, they forgot about museums. But there is that. In stones, in painting, it is there. We enter the grand narrative, then enter the Prado, or enter the Kunsthistorisches Museum, or enter the Metropolitan Museum. We do enter the grand narrative. So this is entirely forgotten, and that has a significance for us. Obviously, it has significance for this 100,000 people who enter this museum, and for them, still remains important in this museum, whether it was created in 500 years before Christ, or 5,000 years before Christ, or 500 years after Christ, things which basically for our eye is not, a postmodern eye does not make any significance. But if you go into this place, it again gains some significance. So I ask the question, why is that so? Because this is entirely forgotten. least I wanted only make you aware of it, that the grand narrative exists, embodied. Yeah?
What just going to the museum as one could just read the Bible and not consider it at all important or significant?
Now, why do people go to the museum? People go more and more into the museums. And perhaps reading the Bible. We read the Bible and the two things do not contradict each other. Read the Bible, I talked about it, basically it's a master narrative. And the master narrative is not a grand narrative. Master narrative is totally different from the grand narrative. Yes, I now understand your question. Because the master narrative is the narrative to which we constantly return. To which we constantly interpret, which is in a way coeval with us. The master narrative is, although it introduces linear history in the case of the Bible, we also feel that it is coeval with us. We do not historicize the master narrative. Give you an example. Christmas, for example. When you are celebrating Christmas, you do not say that I celebrate the 2000th year anniversary of Christ's birth. It's not a 2000 year anniversary. Yeah? And that is not the 933 years anniversary. That doesn't exist when you speak about the events in the Bible. You do not think that it happened 2000 years ago, and you celebrate something which happened 2000 years ago. You celebrate, you speak about something which happens always now. Yeah? Always now, it's coeval. The grand narrative is coeval even if it happened not many, many years ago. It's different. Because we return to learning even if we do not know anything about it. But the grand narrative is a meta-narrative. Grand narrative is a narrative which includes all the historical narratives of different people, what Hegel called the spirit of nations. That the grand narrative can speak first about the history of the Egyptians, and the history of Babylonia and Assyria, the history of Persia, old Persia, then come and in between the history of the Jews and the history, the whole story of the Bible is a little, I would say, very short story in the grand narrative, because it is a story of a small people and for a small time. Then you continue with the Greeks and you continue with the Romans, and you tell us what were the achievements of this or that and that. All achievements are in a way, including the previous achievement. That is, the later achievement is always higher than the previous achievement, not absolutely in something, absolutely not, but at least in something. So it goes on and arriving to the present day. This is the grand narrative. In Hegel, the present is the culmination, because now the work is accomplished. We arrive at the end of history. For Karl Marx, the present is something which is the focal point for the preparation of the future, where history will end. He also speaks about the end of history, that history will end afterwards in times of communism. That will be the end of history. But the conception is all this linear history. Conflicts, but linear history. At the end, you get to truth. The end is the truth. And this is the grand narrative. It's not master narrative. The master narrative don't tell you the end of truth. There is no such a thing there. A grand narrative is historicizing philosophy. It does not historicize religion. It does not historicize politics. It historicizes philosophy. And religion and politics and art play their own part in the historicizing of philosophy, because philosophy is the highest of the philosophy will be realized. In Hegel, philosophy is realized in the present. For Marx, philosophy is going to be realized in the future. But this is grand narrative. This is totally different from master narratives.
Yeah, I guess could you elaborate a little bit more about the point you were making with Derrida and the concept of truth, because it did seem to me as if there you were indicating some support for some sort of, right, we don't have any longer absolute truth, but my sense was that you were saying doing some sort of regular and constant truth. And I just wondered how I got you right or...
So what I mentioned here only very briefly, because I wrote two different essays on this problem, one on Foucault and one on Derrida, so I mentioned only here on the sideline, that they were the two authors, according to me, who approached with all sincerity the contemporary problem with truth. Foucault, in the way that he reversed the question itself, he hasn't asked the question what truth is, but he asked the question how is truth produced. And since he reversed the question, he could very frequently keep the traditional answers. Now, Derrida hasn't reversed the question. He presents us with text. The text, all texts are about truth. The texts are about truth, entirely heterogeneous texts. Certain things are said. Certain things are regarded as true. It is elaborated by the text. And this truth deconstructs itself, and is replaced by the other one. And this deconstructs itself, and is replaced by the new one. All truths are...